Nemoto presents pioneers of psychology and psychiatry. Jean Piaget, The Logic of Childhood. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 21 minutes. A teenage boy sits at his desk in Neuchâtel, Switzerland, brow furrowed in concentration as he reads a letter that has just arrived. The year is 1911, and Jean Piaget, only 15 years old, has received astonishing news. His former nanny has confessed that the dramatic story he'd been told as a child, how she fought off a kidnapper who tried to snatch baby Jean from his carriage, was entirely made up. In the letter, the ex-nurse apologizes for having lied years ago to cover her own neglect. Jean sets the letter down, heart pounding. He is bewildered, even embarrassed, to realize that he possesses a detailed memory of the attempted kidnapping, the struggle, the nanny's heroic cries, even the police officer's uniform. Yet none of it ever happened. How could he remember something that was a fiction? Young Piaget gazes out the window at the gathering dusk over Lake Neuchâtel, his mind racing with questions. This moment, the shattering of a vivid false memory, plants a seed in him that will grow into one of the great quests in the history of psychology, an investigation into how we construct knowledge and how the mind of a child, in particular, forms its own logic of reality. To understand how Jean Piaget became the world's foremost explorer of childhood thought, one must first picture him as a child himself, curious, precocious, and almost unbearably inquisitive. He was born on August 9, 1896, in the French-speaking city of Neuchâtel, the eldest child of Arthur Piaget, a professor of medieval literature, and Rebecca Jackson, who came from a prominent family of merchants. From his father, Jean inherited a love of rigorous scholarship. From his mother, perhaps, a spirited determination. By age 10, he was already making original observations of the natural world. Family lore recounts how one day at that age, Jean spotted a curious sparrow flitting about, an albino sparrow with pure white feathers. Fascinated, he wrote a short report on the bird, which was subsequently published in a local journal. It was an extraordinary achievement for a child, and it was only the beginning. By his mid-teens, Jean had published several papers on mollusks, establishing a reputation among European zoologists as a wunderkind in malacology, the study of mollusks. He spent hours sketching snails and analyzing their shells, displaying the patient focus of a scientist in training. Yet amid his scientific pursuits, Piaget was equally drawn to big philosophical questions. He read voraciously in philosophy and epistemology, pondering the nature of knowledge itself. It was perhaps inevitable that he would seek a path that combined these interests, the biological and the epistemological. In 1918, at 22 years old, Piaget earned his doctorate in zoology from the University of Neuchâtel. His dissertation on mollusks was complete, but instead of continuing purely in biology, he found himself increasingly captivated by psychology, a field that promised to illuminate how organisms, especially humans, adapt and come to know their world. Encouraged by his godfather, who was a scholar of philosophy, Piaget plunged into the nascent science of the mind. After graduating, he went to Zurich to study psychology, bringing along his keen biologist's eye and his lifelong interest in how knowledge is formed. In Zurich, he had the chance to work briefly under the famed psychiatrist Carl Jung and to attend lectures by Eugen Buller, who had coined the term schizophrenia. This exposure to psychoanalytic and clinical ideas further opened Piaget's mind to the mysteries of thought. But it was only when he moved to Paris in 1919 that he found his true calling. Imagine young Piaget in Paris just after World War I, a lanky, intense Swiss researcher amid the bustle of the Sorbonne. He secured a position in the laboratory of Alfred Binet, the developer of the Binet-Simon intelligence tests for children. Piaget assisted in the marking of Binet's intelligence tests. Day after day, he sat poring over children's test papers, dozens, then hundreds of them, checking right and wrong answers. It was tedious work in one sense, but Piaget's scientific curiosity soon transformed it into something else entirely. He began to notice a pattern that others had overlooked. The younger children weren't just getting questions wrong at random, they were making the same kinds of mistakes. In fact, their wrong answers were often remarkably consistent and seemed to reveal a distinct logic at work. Older children and adults did not make these particular errors, but younger children did, over and over. For example, when asked if there were more daisies or more flowers in a certain picture, the young children would confidently answer, "More daisies," failing to realize that all daisies are also flowers. When shown two identical rows of counters and then one row was spread out, they insisted the spread out row had more counters, unable to grasp that number doesn't change with spacing. These weren't mere mistakes. Piaget realized he was witnessing a different mode of thinking. His colleagues in Binet's lab were primarily interested in quantifying children's intelligence, ranking them by IQ scores. But Piaget was seized by a more profound question. Asterisk, what was the child's mind doing when it gave these answers? What logic or rules was it following? Asterisk, the children weren't being willfully obstinate or foolish. In fact, their answers often had an internal consistency. Piaget began talking with the children, interviewing them in an open-ended, conversational style as they worked through problems. He would pose tasks like, "Can you make me a clay snake that has the same amount of clay as this ball?" and then gently press them to explain their reasoning. A little girl might assert that a taller, thinner cup has more water than a short, wide one because it's higher, revealing how she focused on one aspect of the problem, height, to the exclusion of others. Piaget found these dialogues exhilarating. Here, in the chatter of Parisian school children, was a new frontier of science, the qualitative study of how children think. By 1921, not even 25 years old, Piaget had published several papers detailing his startling findings about children's reasoning. His work drew attention among educational psychologists in Europe. That same year, he was invited back to Switzerland to become director of the Institut Jean-Jacques Rousseau in Geneva, an institute dedicated to the scientific study of education and child development. Piaget jumped at the chance. Geneva would remain his home base for the rest of his life, and the Rousseau Institute, later incorporated into the University of Geneva, became the cradle of his cognitive experiments. Settling in Geneva, Piaget continued his research with unflagging enthusiasm. In 1923, he married Valentine Chadenet, a French woman who shared his love of learning. They would have three children, two daughters and a son, and these children became, in a sense, Piaget's most cherished experimental subjects. From their infancy, Piaget observed them with the care of both a loving father and a scientist. He took copious notes on their development, how his baby daughter, Jacqueline, searched for a toy that had been hidden under a blanket or failed to search, depending on her age, an observation that would lead to his concept of object permanence, the understanding that things continue to exist even when one can't see them. He noted how his toddler son, Laurent, engaged in egocentric talk, chattering to himself without any intent to communicate, illuminating the early stage when children haven't yet realized that others have separate minds. Every peekaboo game, every child's why, question at the dinner table, even the children's squabbles over rules of a game, fed into Piaget's ever-evolving theory. It was as if he was mapping the development of human knowledge itself, one small revelation at a time. Through careful observation and ingenious little experiments, Piaget began to sketch out a grand theory of cognitive development. He proposed that children are not empty vessels to be filled with information, nor are they miniature adults who think the same way as grown-ups do. Rather, he saw children as active builders of knowledge, little scientists who constantly create and test their own theories about the world. In Piaget's view, the growth of knowledge is a process of adaptation. The child's mind constantly seeks to fit new information into its existing mental structures, a process he called assimilation, and at the same time those structures themselves adjust to accommodate the new information, accommodation. This dynamic interplay leads to the formation of qualitatively new ways of understanding reality as the child matures. By observing many children, including his own, and presenting them with problems, Piaget identified a sequence of developmental stages, each characterized by a distinct kind of thinking. The first was the sensorimotor stage, spanning roughly from birth to age 2. In this stage, infants think with their senses and actions. They explore by seeing, sucking, grasping, banging. A baby learns that when she shakes a rattle, it makes a sound, cause, and effect. She discovers that objects still exist even when she can't see them. Peekaboo ceases to be so thrilling once she grasps that the hidden face is still there behind the hands. Piaget watched his own infants gradually acquire these sensorimotor insights, noting the exact ages at which they achieved milestones like retrieving a hidden object. Next comes the preoperational stage, roughly ages 2 to 7, when the child can use symbols and language, but is not yet capable of logical operations in the adult sense. During these years, a child's thinking is wonderfully imaginative and rich with pretend play. A broomstick becomes a horse, an empty box a pirate ship. But the child is also egocentric, meaning they struggle to see things from perspectives other than their own. Piaget's famous Three Mountains experiment illustrated this. He'd show a child a model of three mountains of different sizes and ask what a doll, placed at a different viewpoint, would see. The preoperational child would describe the scene only from their own vantage point, unable to imagine the doll's perspective. Piaget understood that this was not selfishness, but simply the natural limitation of a young mind not yet equipped for complex empathy or spatial reasoning. From around 7 to 11 years old, children enter the concrete operational stage. Now, logical thinking finally blooms, but only in reference to concrete, tangible objects and events. The child can solve problems of conservation, understanding, for example, that the amount of liquid in a glass remains the same even when poured into a differently shaped glass as long as nothing is added or taken away. A sense of time, number, and causality becomes more reliable. Piaget marveled at how a child around 8 or 9 suddenly gets it that stretching out a row of coins doesn't increase their number, or that if 4 plus 3 is equal to 7, then 7 to 3 must equal 4. The logic of the concrete world clicks into place. Still, these children usually can't grapple with hypothetical or abstract concepts. Their reasoning is anchored to the real and present. Finally, around the onset of adolescence, the formal operational stage emerges, in which the person can think abstractly and hypothetically. Teenagers can ponder questions like, what is justice? Or solve algebraic equations with unknowns. They can imagine alternative realities, leading, often, to idealism and critical questioning of the status quo. Piaget noted that not everyone reaches full formal operational thinking in all areas. It depends on education and experience. But in principle, this stage opens the door to the full spectrum of adult reasoning. These stages, as Piaget outlined them, were not rigid age-bound boxes, but general phases, each building on the previous one. And crucially, Piaget believed that the sequence was universal. All children, in all cultures, go through these stages in the same order, though the timing can vary. This was a bold claim, and it spurred as much research and debate as any theory in psychology. Piaget, however, did not arrive at it lightly. He spent decades gathering evidence. He loved nothing more than devising simple, yet clever tests to probe a child's thinking, then listening with patience and respect to the child's explanation. In one instance, he gave 2 5-year-olds identical lumps of clay and rolled one into a sausage shape before their eyes. He asked if one had more clay now. The children insisted the long one had more, until Piaget gently rolled it back into a ball, showing nothing was added or lost. Such interactions might seem trivial, but to Piaget they were full of meaning. They revealed how children at different stages perceive reality and how their understanding can shift. As his ideas coalesced, Piaget began to publish books that would revolutionize developmental psychology. In quick succession, he wrote The Language and Thought of the Child, 1923, and Judgment and Reasoning in the Child, 1924, documenting his Paris findings, followed by a steady stream of works in the 1930s and 1940s that delved deeper into children's conceptions of number, space, time, and morality. His writing was scholarly, but his subject matter, children's quirky but systematic ways of reasoning, captured wide interest. Here was a scientist treating the child's mind with a seriousness and wonder previously reserved for fields like astronomy or physics. Piaget's name began to be known outside academia. Parents and teachers found in his descriptions a mirror of the children they lived and worked with daily. In the mid-20th century, as the world rebuilt after World War II, Piaget's influence grew international. He continued to lead the Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute, eventually serving as co-director and also teaching at the University of Geneva, mentoring students from around the globe who came to learn the clinical method of interviewing children that he pioneered. In 1955, he founded the International Center for Genetic Epistemology in Geneva, essentially a research center dedicated to interdisciplinary study of how knowledge develops, reflecting Piaget's lifelong quest to bridge philosophy and psychology. He convened scholars from psychology, biology, logic, and sociology to collaborate on understanding the genesis of knowledge, hence genetic epistemology, using genetic in the sense of origins. It was an ambitious, perhaps utopian project, but it underscored how far Piaget's ideas had reached. He was no longer just watching children count beads. He was addressing how humanity as a whole builds meaning. Piaget remained a modest man in demeanor, soft-spoken, with an ever-present twinkle in his eye, but his ideas were sweeping in their impact. Education, in particular, underwent a quiet revolution because of him. Before Piaget, many educators thought of children as relatively passive learners to be filled with facts, and intelligence as something largely fixed that could be measured with tests. After Piaget, enlightened educators began to see the classroom differently. If a child's ability to grasp a concept depended on their developmental stage, then teaching had to be tailored to that readiness. For example, expecting a 4-year-old to understand abstract algebra was futile, not because the child was dumb, but because the child's mind had not yet reached that stage of logical structure. The role of a teacher, Piaget suggested, was less a transmitter of information and more a facilitator or guide for exploration. Hands-on learning, discovery-based education, and respect for the child's point of view gained traction, thanks in part to Piaget's work. In the 1960s and 1970s, his theories became particularly influential in the United States, dovetailing with the progressive education movement. New math and science curricula were designed to introduce concepts at developmentally appropriate stages, often using concrete objects and visual aids to match children's modes of thinking. Though revered as a pioneer, Piaget was not without his critics. Later researchers pointed out that he may have underestimated children's abilities, or that with guidance, children can sometimes handle more advanced tasks than Piaget thought. Others noted he paid scant attention to how culture and social interaction might influence cognitive development, areas where the Russian psychologist Lev Vygotsky offered alternative perspectives. Piaget, ever the scientist, welcomed most of this dialogue. He remained actively engaged in research and theory into his old age, revising and refining aspects of his theory. Where he saw merit in criticisms, he incorporated new ideas, and where he disagreed, he designed new studies to test the issues. The field he effectively created, developmental cognitive psychology, continued to evolve, but always built on the foundation he laid. Jean Piaget lived a long, intellectually rich life. He and Valentine grew old together in Geneva, and he was reportedly a devoted grandfather, observing the next generation of young minds with the same fascination he had for his own children. In 1972, He was awarded the prestigious Erasmus Prize for his contributions to social science, and in 1979, the year before his death, he received the Bolzan Prize. By the time Piaget passed away on September 16, 1980, at the age of 84, he was widely celebrated as one of the towering figures of 20th century psychology. In accordance with his wishes, he was buried in an unmarked grave, a humble conclusion for a man who had illuminated so much. There was something poetic about that choice. Piaget never sought personal glory. He sought knowledge. And knowledge, to him, was a living, growing thing. Today, the name Piaget is virtually synonymous with the study of cognitive development. His theory, the logic of childhood, fundamentally changed how we view children, not as incomplete adults, but as individuals with their own coherent inner worlds. If you've ever watched a child intently exploring a toy, testing what happens, you have witnessed what Piaget described, a young scientist at work. If teachers now gauge not just what children learn, but how they think, that too is part of Piaget's legacy. He showed us that to truly understand the human mind, we must begin at the beginning, in the cradle and sandbox, in the imaginative make-believe and earnest questions of childhood. There, in those small moments, lie the origins of reason, the building blocks of logic, and the enduring wonder of discovery.